You know, I'm not a huge fan of fetishizing our tools, but I think that we're at an inflection point right now with tools that is a very important thing to recognize, that we are reducing friction over and over again to realizing ideas. So there's just less time and effort required from idea to high fidelity prototype that feels so real, you can't tell that it's fake. And that's a big deal because that makes it possible for us to learn faster.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview successful UX designers who fight for the user in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to episode 27. I'm your host, Jason Ogle. Today, I got to interview another one of my design superheroes, and probably yours, Aaron Walter. He probably doesn't even need an intro. What I will tell you is that he cast a very large UX design shadow. Many of the practices he orchestrated while at MailChimp have served as models for countless designers creating outstanding experiences today. Aaron is quite a storyteller, as he says, stories make the world go round. So I just knew he'd be a great fit for this show. I'll stop narrowing now so we can get to my inspiring interview with Aaron Walter. This episode is brought to you in part by Universal Mind, a digital design and consulting company based in Denver, Colorado. Picture the ideal state for your business. In a complex and ever-changing digital world, Universal Mind will help you get there through design thinking workshops, UX strategy and design, technology consulting, agile services, and software development. They also believe in supporting user defenders to train and inspire the next generation of designers. Learn more at universalmind.com. Aaron Walter is the VP of Design Education at Envision. Prior to this, he founded the UX practice at MailChimp, along with many other accomplishments too numerable to mention here. He's the author of one of my favorite design books, Designing for Emotion. He's a frequent speaker at conferences around the world, and his design guidance has helped the White House, the U.S. Department of State, along with dozens of startups and venture capitalists. He's run with the Bulls in Pamplona, met three presidents, been blessed by the Pope, and bungee jumped off a 10-story crane. Eat your heart out, most interesting man in the world. How's it going, Aaron?
It's going great. Thanks for having me.
I'm super excited to have you on User Defenders today.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. So every superhero has a secret identity and origin story, and let's talk about yours. I'd like to start the show by you taking a few moments to give us a look into your personal life.
So personal life. I live in Athens, Georgia. I've been here for 16 years. I love this city because it's a creative place. You know, I just know so many people that come from lots of different backgrounds, and I find that to be good for my brain. Good way to learn. My background, I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in Iowa and Nebraska and Missouri and moved around a bit. As a kid, I fell in love with drawing and painting. And art was always something I was really passionate about. And when I went to undergrad and graduate school, that's what I studied. I studied painting and drawing and kind of got connected with, interested in the web and technology in graduate school. But there were some moments in my life along the way where I, discovered computers and started to make things and do creative things with computers too. So, so that's me.
Awesome. So are you still painting by chance?
I'm not a painter. I'm no longer a painter. Okay. I love painting. Still, I have a great love and respect for it, but I feel like, you know, I get what I need creatively from the work that I do now. So it doesn't feel like a loss or something I had to give up. That's usually the way people see it when they hear I don't paint. But yeah, I often say that, you know, when I was a kid, I felt like I could change the world with a painting. And then I kind of grew up and realized that painting doesn't actually have a very broad reach. The web and software is the medium of our time, and that's how we reach a lot of people and we can, you know, do bigger things.
Well said. Tell us your origin story. You did a little bit, but I would love to know what inspired you to pursue a career in this exciting, challenging, and ever-evolving field?
I kind of chose this field, but I kind of fell into it as well. You know, I was in college right as the web was starting to take shape. I remember a friend of mine that I grew up with, his name's Tony. We were at the University of Iowa, and he took me to a computer lab on campus. And I saw a bunch of people just kind of sitting around, and he was telling me, all these people are on the web right now. And I was like, what does that mean? And basically they were on BBS systems, you know, bulletin board systems, talking to other people. And he tried to explain it to me, and I just thought, okay, it's pretty nerdy. I don't really see this thing ever catching on, because it wasn't really applied. But Tony was actually an important person in my life in terms of getting me into the web and the medium, because he's the first person that showed it to me. And then we actually ended up in Philadelphia together. He had graduated from undergrad, and he wanted to try living in a new city. I was moving out to Philadelphia to go to grad school. And so he's like, yeah, I'll go with you and hang out and get a job and see what's going on. And he was my roommate for a while, and he ended up teaching me HTML. Hmm. He taught me how to make an animated GIF from scratch, because that's the way you made them. animated GIFs were relatively new, making image maps by hand. And while I was in grad school, I was making super tedious paintings, and the feedback loop was just so long, where I would work on a painting for, 3 weeks, maybe a month, and I'd get to the end of that painting and maybe I liked it and felt satisfied by the work, or maybe I didn't. And so I started to study, I took a Photoshop class to try to prototype those ideas more quickly, shorten the feedback loop, to be able to make, better work. And then I got a bit more interested in those images. They weren't exactly art, but I wanted to make them interactive. I wanted to animate them. And so I took another class where I learned Director and Lingo and After Effects. And essentially, I just sort of grabbed a thread, and the thread just kept going. And by the time I graduated graduate school, I had gotten pretty far into building websites, building CD-ROMs, making videos, making images. And I got a job at an agency right out of college, which this is that point where I just kind of fell into the work, where I had these skills and I knew that I probably wasn't going to make a whole lot of money making paintings. But I could do this, and I didn't really think of it as a career. I thought of it as like, I'll do this for a little while and see what happens. And so, I worked for this agency. We were really small. And I just learned a ton within about a year's time. I got to, handle accounts, work directly with clients, negotiate contracts. I learned JavaScript. I learned CSS. I learned a lot of Photoshop tricks, just made a lot of stuff. I was making CD-ROMs and websites. And it's just sort of trial by fire. But once I got into that, I kind of knew there was no going back. Like that felt really interesting to me. And it felt like, it's just a lot of excitement and energy in the medium at the time. This was as the dot-com bubble is starting to inflate. So late 90s. And then I just stuck with it.
I see such a storytelling narrative thread, as you put it, in your background, Aaron, and just with the learning Director and the animated GIFs, and just a lot of the motion and your background in painting and drawing. And so I see so much storytelling in your background, and I know you've applied so much of that to your work. But I have to mention this quote you said in your Designing Emotional Experiences talk, which was a great talk also. The most effective design has a narrative thread, and that's a quote from Kit Henricks. So I just want to ask you, how important is storytelling to our work?
I think that storytelling is central to the human experience. I think it transcends our medium, and it just is how we as humans communicate with one another. It's how we share our most personal stories, personal messages, the most critical messages that we need for survival. We've been embedding those messages in stories for millennia. Mm. And so our brains have just become like these super processors of story to pull out the most critical theme or, you know, the moral of the story, if you will. So I'm a fan of people who are great storytellers that, you know, admire that skill because it's a... You know, it's a way to entertain people, to move them, to motivate them. I think that, you know, great CEOs generally tend to be very good storytellers, that they're able to get a lot of different types of people moving in synchronicity, working, you know, collaboratively, all rallied around the why of, you know, this is why we're doing what we're doing. And that's generally communicated in a story. It's so easy to remember. So, you know, painting is definitely about storytelling. I heard John Maeda recently, he said that, you know, art is about asking questions. Design's about offering solutions. Mm. And, you know, I think that's a great way to sum up what art is doing, is trying to ask questions through telling a story. Sometimes it's a very overt narrative thread, but you're connecting a lot of different disconnected ideas into some greater meaning. It always seems to boil down to a story. That's what we're looking for. You know, I think that it's not a mistake that most human beings on this planet, right from left to right, we think of time as a horizon. You know, we see the horizon and we have this personal relationship to it. All these things are sort of connected in our brain and the way that we understand our world. So yeah, storytelling. I mean, it just seems so essential to what we do.
Oh, love it. And this podcast really is all about storytelling, and that's why I really appreciate having you on, because I know you're really big on that. And one interesting thing too is that I think about movies and film, and I think that's still one of the biggest leisurely activities that we do, at least in America here. We go to the movies, and it's the story, it's the escape, it's all of that. Has film played a big role in your influence as a designer as well?
You know, I don't know if it's necessarily shaped my aesthetic, but film is something that I'm very interested in. And TV, I think TV is the new film, because it basically lets storytellers stretch out into, a much more complicated, sophisticated format where characters can be developed more deeply. You know, stories just get a lot more complicated, and you know, people are obsessed with Game of Thrones right now.
Yes.
I read all of those books, and you know, it's interesting to watch all of that story just kind of unpack. So I don't know if film has necessarily influenced my aesthetic, but it's definitely something I think about a lot, and I think about how directors and writers build those stories.
I've been watching Gotham on Netflix, and it's incredible to me. Like you said, it just the story, the possibilities of expanding these stories with these same characters, it's phenomenal. And being able to actually, there's like two stories going on. Like they're trying to find out who killed Bruce Wayne's parents, but also there's like mini stories within this big story. And they just, it's amazing how they do this. There's got to be a lot of stuff happening behind the scenes and right, like wireframing all this out and storyboarding all this, like how these pieces are going to put together. But I'm a big fan of story also. So I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've been thinking a lot about story lately because I'm very curious about how companies scale and how they break. And you know, I mentioned earlier that I've observed that CEOs that tend to be very successful they're able to share the vision of a company, and usually that's through story. And I've seen some instances of companies that use story very effectively. Airbnb is one of the best examples that I've seen. So it's 2012. Their CEO had made the observation that the size of their company at that time was the same size as Walt Disney Studios back in the 30s.
Oh, wow.
And this was right after Walt Disney... The studios had produced Three Little Pigs, which was a big deal because it was in full color and, you know, audio and music. And it really changed the way people thought about animation. But at that time, they had just developed storyboarding as part of the Three Little Pigs process. And it's something that, you know, I guess I didn't really realize was how influential the Walt Disney Studios was in developing these narrative tools and all of these methodologies and devices that are used in animation and filmmaking today. So Airbnb, they recognize that, you know, Walt Disney was this size and we're this size, and they had this transcendent leap. How did they do that? Well, the transcendent leap for Walt Disney Studios was going from Three Little Pigs to creating Snow White. And so if you've seen both those films, you know the aesthetic of Three Little Pigs is a little less sophisticated. It doesn't feel quite as immersive. Snow White, if you look at it, like the depth of color and texture and the types of things that are being animated, it's not so, you know, outlined and structured. It's a lot of ethereal elements like water and smoke and it feels more real. And it's the first full-length animated feature. And they did that. Walt Disney would tell those stories. He told the story of Snow White to the entire studio. He brought them into, they had a stage area, and he was on stage, and he told that story to them so well that he essentially just convinced everybody in one evening, this is what we're going to do. No one has ever done this before. This is monolithic, but we can do it. And they did it, and they produced Snow White, and they won a ton of accolades, and it was a big deal for the studio. So Airbnb took that story in sort of a literal way and created their own Snow White storyboard. That was their code name for it, was Snow White. But they basically... If you think about that business, it's really complicated because you've got a digital experience and a physical experience, and the physical experience is has multiple perspectives. You are the host, or you're the guest, and you have different motivations and different perspectives there. So they ended up storyboarding each process, the host process and the guest process, and they're focusing on how the product fits into the lives of the people that they serve. And they worked with Pixar to create these really great storyboards. Not Pixar itself, but some illustrators from Pixar. And that still is a guide for them today. They have the Snow White storyboards at their headquarters. So, but, you know, I think that's, you know, it's just, it's interesting how people can use these devices to make it clear to an entire company why they're doing what they're doing and give meaning to work.
Hmm. That's awesome. I remember reading about that in one of your recent articles, and yeah, so much inspiration. So groundbreaking too, the work that Disney has done, and the neat partnership there with Airbnb, who's also doing some pretty groundbreaking things as well. So yeah. That's awesome. Thanks for sharing that story, Aaron. Aaron, who's been the biggest superhero in your work and why?
So I had a teacher in eighth grade that was really influential, mainly because he guided me. He helped me feel like I wasn't a kid, like I could, you know. He gave me a lot of confidence. He worked with me on a big, you know, History Day project, which is basically like a science fair type of thing. My friend and I, we ended up going to nationals. Like, we competed and we got all the way to the top of the country competing. We studied Will Rogers, and you know, it was a big deal. I mean, it was a big deal to me as an eighth grader. But it gave me confidence of like, hey, I could do big things if I work really hard. So that was a seminal experience for me. And you know, I had some teachers I had a teacher in undergrad who also did the same sort of thing. Like, I was a kid, I didn't really know much, but he treated me like an adult. And I guess mostly with the respect, of an adult. And he would, you know, help me work on my drawing. I would get to go to his house and hang out with him and his wife, and I would work in his studio on drawings. He would show me the work that he was doing. And just, you know, he treated me like an adult, almost like a friend, but he still was my teacher. You know, there's still that distance there. I think those sorts of experiences were really important to me. I think just, you know, getting confidence as you're growing up and trying to get your bearings in life, knowing that you're capable of a lot more than you think you are. I think that's a really important lesson. And, you know, as I think back in my life, that probably helped me the most.
Wow. I'm moved by that, Aaron. And I can tell you one of the reasons is because I did not have very much confidence at all. And it kept going through high school, and in eighth grade, I was trying to figure out how to not to get caught smoking cigarettes, those kind of things, you know. It's like, and you know, hanging out with the wrong crowd and stuff. So I think that's such a valuable lesson, and it's obviously shaped you into who you are, and the amazing things that you've accomplished and continue to accomplish in your career. So that's an amazing story. Aaron, if you weren't doing this for a living, what would be your second career choice and why?
I have joked with my wife that I wouldn't mind being a barista. I think that'd be fun.
Oh, yes.
I like making coffee.
Man after my own heart.
I like making coffee for other people too. That's fun. Although, man, I got a lot of practice ahead of me to get better.
Well, you guys had an espresso machine at MailChimp, didn't you?
Yeah. That was great. Man. Always nice.
So jealous.
That was cool to work with. But, you know, I like architecture. I'm really interested in the way that space shapes people's behavior. And I don't know. I don't know if I would be a good architect necessarily, but I sure have a fondness for it. I love to explore spaces, like to go into a place that's really well designed, or to design a space that's very creative, you know, that facilitates creativity, or, you know, a space where, like, even museums. I went to Frank Gehry's in Bilbao, the art museum that he designed there, and it's the Guggenheim. And the shapes of the space are so weird, and you know, like, you move through the space really strangely, and I think in some ways it kind of detracts from the arts at some point, but it also just feels like part of the art experience. And I don't know, it's just incredible how you go into a building and it can just change the way that, you know, you view what you're supposed to be doing. I love domestic architecture. My wife and I, my wife studied architecture, so I've learned a lot from her, but we've worked on a number of houses over the years, and that's been really fun.
That's neat. There's so many parallels between architecture and our work on the web. Zeldman talked about that on our interview on episode 20, and just about building things that people need that help make their life better and that they can use, actually.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's a great parallel.
Yeah, and I love how it can bring people together, too.
Oh.
That's really great.
That's good, yeah. Like a coffee house, coming back to the coffee house analogy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk about life-altering experiences and get into your transformation. Now, every superhero has some sort of life-altering experience that helps guide their purpose and leads to a transformation where they realize the powers they have, where they harness them for the greater good. Now, often a significant result of transformation is failure. Now, failure is not something we like to talk about or certainly not put on our LinkedIn page, but it's unquestionably one of life's greatest teachers. Could you tell us a story about what's been the biggest one in your career?
Okay, so I have a clear view of these the transformative point in my life. It wasn't necessarily connected to failure, but failure was definitely a strong possibility. Mm-hmm. So I was a professor for 7 or 8 years, something like that, I had an idea for a book, but I wasn't really sure how to write a book, how to go about this. Like, I knew nothing about it because I hadn't known anyone that wrote a book. Certainly no one in my family or, in my background had ever exposed me to the idea that this was something that was possible. But anyway, I'd been teaching for a while, had an idea, and I wanted to give it a shot, and so I went to South by Southwest in 2007, and I went there for a number of reasons to, meet people and so forth. But one of my key goals was I want to try to talk to someone about this idea for a book and see if this is viable. And I went to, they've got the big trade show area where there are a lot of publishers, a lot of people that, are showing new products and stuff. And I walked up to a man in a booth, which was Peach Pit Press, which is part of Pearson.
Yes.
And I knew that I would, my ideal was I'd love to be able to publish with new writers because, Jeffrey Zeldman published with new writers. And there were a lot of other authors that I really respected that published through them. And so I thought, I'll just start with these guys. I'll take it on the chin and learn a bit and then try for plan B or plan C, see if I can find someone that's interested. So I walked up in this booth and, some days, I don't know about you, but some days I wake up feeling confident. Some days I just feel like, I'm not confident at all.
Yep. Me too.
And this day I felt like, I'll give it a shot. What can I lose? Simply because it seemed so, unattainable to me. And the person I happened to walk up to, I said, "Hey, who do I talk to about a book idea?" And he said, "Well, that'd be me. Tell me all about it." So I talked to him about the book idea. I talked to him about the gap, there's nothing out there. But this is something that is needed. I told him about my background a little bit. I tried to keep it short. And this guy was like, "Yeah, this is pretty interesting. I'm going to go on vacation for the next 2 weeks. But when I get back, I would love for a proposal to be in my inbox so I can check it out and we can try to take this further." And so, I went away. I worked on that proposal. I sent it to him. I worked really hard on that proposal. And he got it and he was like, "Yeah, this is great. We want to sign a deal with you." And it turns out that guy was Michael Nolan, who is the acquisitions editor for Jeffrey Zeldman. So he signed Jeffrey's book and worked with him on all the different editions. So total luck that I happened to walk up to the right guy. Total luck that it happened to be a day where I was articulate and could actually, communicate my idea coherently. And total luck that he saw something in this book idea, because everything pivots on that point for me. Because otherwise, I think I'd still be teaching, which is great. I loved it. It was, when you talk about what's another profession you might be doing, that would be one. Hmm. From that, I ended up meeting Jeffrey. Jeffrey invited me to come speak at an event apart. And then I ended up getting invited to speak at a lot of conferences. While I was writing that book, I was talking to Ben Chestnut, who's the co-founder and CEO of MailChimp. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, I'm going to write a little bit about MailChimp. Could I come in and talk to you guys as part of my research? And Ben said, well, why don't you just come start our design team? So from that one conversation, my career changed. And my life changed pretty dramatically from that point forward. So I think it's fascinating to hear stories where people know, like, that's the turning point. It happened right there. And also fascinating to ponder, like, what if? What if you hadn't done it? Hmm. So the moral of the story for me is, I'm going to try. I'm going to give it a shot regardless of the outcome, that I might not get this right. I might fail at this. I'm going to give it a shot because the upside could be really good.
Great, great takeaway, defenders. Just go for it. Be confident in yourself. Just be bold. You have a lot to offer. And you may not even realize it, as Aaron said, and just go for it. And that's a great story. I don't see the failure in that as much as the failure, I think, would be not trying, right, in that lesson?
Yeah, yeah. I've got a ton of failures in my career, that's for sure. Innumerable, working on projects that didn't take off, or, design ideas that were terrible. But, we learn along the way.
Yeah. And we practice, right? We practice by putting stuff out there, and we can grow thicker skin and gain more confidence. Because even with maybe after the 19th no, you'll get a yes on the 20th, right?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Love
That's
it.
That's true.
What was that story? What was the book that you were pitching? What was it about?
It's called Building Findable Websites, and it was pretty popular for a while. It came out in 2008.
Awesome.
But it was trying to take a look at how people discover content on the web at that time. Hmm. RSS was a big thing, but it wasn't really mainstream. Microformats were really popular. We were still fighting the web standards battle. So it was... Hmm. Trying to explore like syndication and the way that code makes content more discoverable. So,
oh, that's cool.
It was technical.
Yeah, well, it sounds definitely there was definitely a gap needed to be filled for that, especially at that time. Do you remember how easy it was to be able to get your website on number one result on Google using doorway pages?
Yeah, no kidding.
It used to be so easy.
Yeah.
A lot has changed.
Yep.
But that's probably for the better, because there's a lot of noise out there.
Yep.
So I know that, and I've been doing a lot of homework on you and really enjoying that. And I know that your work at MailChimp, it's the success that has come from MailChimp, I would say, has a lot to do not only with the great people that work there, but in the research that you all did to make sure that this product is exactly what it needs to be and that it works. So I know you've done a ton of research and user testing, and I would just want to ask you, do you have a story of something really crazy or super awkward that happened during one of those sessions?
I don't really have a good story of awkward, but I can tell you a story about a time when I felt really uncomfortable.
Okay.
We would do these interviews. We called them switch interviews. And this is part of the jobs to be done methodology, where you try to understand people's motivations and what shapes their behavior. And you talk to people who have just bought or people have just left your product. And we were interviewing a customer who had just left MailChimp, and you know, she was telling us a story as to why she was. So what we do is we try to frame it like a documentary. We ask them where they were, like what time of day it was. We try to put ourselves in the place where the decision was made, because that gives us the context and we really understand the situation and the behavior very clearly. So asking a bunch of questions about that, she was at her shop. She ran a secondhand goods shop that was huge. It was a pretty big business, actually. She was there at night. It was about 8:30 at night, on her computer, trying to design an email. And it wasn't going so well. She couldn't figure out how to do it. She kept trying to format the specific piece of text and make a column. It just would not apply the formatting that she wanted. So she hadn't had dinner. Her family was at home waiting for her. And it was just getting later and later. It was dark outside. And she was so tired and she wanted to go home. And she saw an ad for our competitor in some sort of like banner ad embedded in a piece of software that she was using.
Oh no.
And so she clicked on that because she was so frustrated with MailChimp. She clicked on that. She went over to our competitor and tried to sign up, and it failed. So she called them and said, I want to sign up. And they said, okay, well, we'll design your email template for you. And you know, it'll be this monthly fee, which was like 10 times more than what we cost. Wow. And designing your template will cost X hundreds of dollars. And with us, she was paying like $15 a month or something to that effect. So it was totally like a crazy jump in price. Hmm. And so the person she was talking to hung up on her. Hmm. She called back again, got a different person. They signed her up. But then she couldn't log in, back and forth that she went with these people. And she finally got to the point where she got a person on the phone again. And it was like the fourth call where she was trying to switch. And she told them, just take my effing money.
Oh, man.
She just like had this intense rage and anger.
And not in an Apple way, right?
No. She just wanted to switch away from MailChimp, and it was really just like she had some bad code in this template, which was, you know, like maybe there were some things we could have done, but part of it was a bit out of our control. And she was just trying to sign up for this other product and was so frustrated with everything in this experience. And man, I just felt her pain. I felt so awkward having this conversation with her when she was so angry, but I think it's good to hear that sort of thing because it helps you. It definitely lit a fire under me that, you know, what can I do to make this product experience better? That's important.
Yeah. And after you probably wrote your Designing with Empathy talk, I would imagine it probably just reinforced that much more, right? The empathy factor.
Yeah, I think that was the came before, but yeah, it's definitely stuck in my mind.
Yeah, I love what you say too. It convicted me, to be honest, because we're sitting in our desks in our cushy chairs and with our specialty coffee roast next to us and our headphones on, just jamming and designing our stuff, and we're not the ones using the product, and so we're really not getting outside of our comfort zones and outside of ourselves to really figure it out. Right. I love how you put that.
Yeah. You know, it's really easy to feel like you're being as effective as possible when you're operating within a bubble. But, the more you talk to customers, the more you'll feel uncomfortable, which is probably why people don't do it as often as they should, is because they just feel bad doing it. but it definitely, helps inform our work, helps motivate us to do, you know, make better products.
Yes. And I love how you say designers, we need to feel more pain.
Yeah, I think a little bit of pain is okay.
Yeah, totally. Because I think that helps us produce our best work, right?
It at least helps us produce more grounded work.
Mm.
you know,
that's good.
Instead of like thinking we've got it figured out, it takes the arrogance out of us.
Mm. Well put. Aaron, what's your design superpower?
I think my design superpower is relates to seeing the big picture, kind of a broader vision for what could be. That was always my role at MailChimp, was looking down the road, understanding what our customers are doing, being able to read between the lines instead of asking customers what they want, but like listening to what they're doing, understanding their business, and seeing a future where we could make products that solve problems for them that they might not even see just yet. It's always been about, seeing what's coming next.
That's great. And I'd imagine research is a big part of that, right? Informing those decisions.
It is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a big part of it. I do think that, that skill of being able to see the big picture it's a critical thinking skill.
Yeah.
That I got from painting.
Oh, interesting.
Because that's about connecting the disconnected and seeing what could be possible. It certainly feels connected to me that's where that comes from. And then the research is sort of the fodder that informs that.
Hmm. Well, adversely, what's your design kryptonite?
You know, I can't say that I love getting deep into every single minute detail in design. I love working with people who are obsessed with details, and I am an appreciator of sweating the details, but man, like for me to, I want to look through the telescope, not the microscope.
Nice.
The best way to describe
That's
it.
That's a great analogy. The thing that occurs to me is these kind of go hand in hand here, because your superpower is the big picture, as you just said, and then the minute details is kind of maybe more of a kryptonite. And I think the beauty of that is that we all bring different strengths to the table. And when we have great teams, which you talk a lot about and articulate very well, it's kind of like, let's everybody bring their strengths to this team, and we don't have to do everything exceptionally well. We can all complement one another, right?
Yeah, it's true. In fact, at MailChimp, I always talk to my team members individually about their superpowers and their kryptonite, and I would use those exact words.
Oh, funny.
It's really, really helpful because I found that when people knew what they were good at, and that's such a strange thing that a lot of times people just don't really know what they're really good at. They have to be told, like, oh, okay, I do that thing, and it turns out that I do that better than most people.
Huh.
So maybe on this project, I should raise my hand and volunteer for this piece. And if they know their kryptonite, what they're not so good at, it's good coaching so they can learn where they can improve. But it also tells them when they might need to give way to a colleague who's a bit more skilled in that area.
That's excellent advice. And I just want to say to the defenders listening, that may be you, and you may be like, I don't know what I'm good at, and I really need to be informed a little more about that. And just ask somebody, ask the people around you what they see, what they think you're really good at. That's great advice, and that can help really inform that, but also give us that confidence that we need to really just go all in on that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
That's awesome. So I'd like to caveat this question as we were just talking about teams and the importance of surrounding yourself with people that make you better. I know that you wouldn't say you got where you are on your own, Aaron, but you certainly achieved a great level of success in your work. So I'd like to ask you, what would your UX design superhero name be?
I guess I like the Falcon. Ooh. That sounds good. That sounds real good.
Wow. Why the Falcon?
Falcons are up high in the sky, seeing far ahead.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It'd probably be a really cool costume, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes, it would. My artist, Caesar, is going to have a blast with this because all of my guests get a superhero artwork thanks to Caesar Lemus. So that is a great one. He's going to have fun.
Awesome.
Yes. Aaron, one of my favorite lines from Tron was when he said, "I fight for the users." How do you fight for your users?
Just by paying attention, just by listening and observing and being curious. I think that that's so important. I've always been a fan of learning from our customers. And, you know, part of it is listening to what they're struggling with. Which is, as I said earlier, it's really uncomfortable a lot of times, especially with like usability testing, when someone leaves and tells you why they left. But also, you know, fighting for the user by understanding the broader trends in the market and culture, how technology and culture intersect, and trying to create a vision for a better future that we could shape by, you know, making new tools. That's something that we always did at MailChimp. You know, we had the luxury of having a research team that was had a generous budget and a lot of time to really learn from customers. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes we would find ideas for the next product by just getting to hang out and do ethnographic studies with our customers. We'd go to their business, hang out with them, watch them work, see the hardware they're using, see the constraints of the space, see how they're interrupted, see how they learn about new things, you know, start to kind of absorb the value system of their culture. And all of that, as you do that over and over again, you start to see patterns, patterns in behavior, patterns in problems. And when you can see those problems, then you start to realize how you could make a new product that would solve those problems for them.
Well, that's a great segue into my next question. And this is a kind of a big one. We're always thinking about the future. You touched on that a little bit, but what does the future of UX look like to you?
I will say it seems really complex, like it's getting ever more complex.
Yeah.
I think the future of UX is faster, lower friction, with tools tailored for our needs. I think that, you know, it's cross-device focused. I think that it's really rich and alive with, you know, lots of different types of media and motion and, things start to feel alive, a lot less static. But I think the tools thing, you know, I'm not a huge fan of fetishizing our tools, but I think that we're at an inflection point right now with tools that is a very important thing to recognize, that we are reducing friction over and over again to realizing ideas. So there's just less time and effort required from idea to, you know, initial prototype, high fidelity prototype that feels so real, you can't tell that it's fake.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal because that makes it possible for us to learn faster. And it means the types of experiences we're going to be able to create are going to be ever more sophisticated, because we can see, we're going to be able to see the possibilities of the work more easily. So if we're able to come up with a product idea and prototype that within, you know, the same morning, perhaps, you know, like that's totally feasible now. And the prototype that we're producing has animation built in. It's got multiple pathways. You can enter content into a form, you know, like the thing feels real. It scrolls, yeah. The menus pop out and so forth. If we can do that, if we can start to prototype with motion, then we start to have more sophisticated motion that mimics physical objects in the real world. And so basically we just continue to bend technology back towards us instead of we bend towards technology, which is what we've been doing historically. You know, like the idea of a mouse is such a hack to teach humans how to interact with a computer, you know, versus a touchscreen device where the technology bends towards us, that we have pointers built in. We don't need an external device to, you know, to hack that for us. It's just natural for us to interact with it, with our body parts, doing what humans do. So I just see that continually coming back to us. And, you know, I'm interested in what happens with language and how we, you know, with things like Alexa, how we'll be able to input more effortlessly. Mm-hmm. We have a long ways to go. And from where I stand, I think we've got a lot still to figure out there. But and then, you know, just our software is going to be more ubiquitous. It's just in everything. It's just going to be in everything, and it helps us expedite things. It helps us quantify things. It helps us, you know, just like reduce the friction of life.
A lot of good stuff in that answer. And you ended up at a great place that's helping to shape some of these tools. So I've been so impressed with InVision and the Craft tool, just to name one, and all the things that you guys keep adding to that is incredible. So you're right. We have such great tools now available to us, and it's finding the ones that work best for us, for our work. And loving Craft, by the way. So it's awesome.
Yeah, me too. And, you know, I was an InVision user for years before joining. So, I see it from that perspective too. And I saw how it changed the way that we worked at MailChimp. It changed the way we work in such a positive way. So I just find that really exciting.
Yeah, it's exhilarating. It is. And it drives me, especially to talk to people like you and who are helping to shape this stuff. So, and I know our defenders, that's the reason they listen to really stay on top of things and to stay inspired. So it's absolutely an exciting time to be doing this stuff.
Hey, this is Austin Knight. I'm a senior UX designer at HubSpot, and I fight for the users. You're listening to the User Defenders podcast with Jason Ogle.
Let's wrap up the show with imparting of superpowers. What's one habit that you believe contributes to your success?
I make sure that I have plenty of inputs. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important thing, and choosing where we get inputs is important. I think that a lot of times, especially in the web design world, people look for inspiration from inside of the medium, and that creates a bit of an echo chamber. I try to take inspiration from a lot of different types of places. You know, I mentioned architecture earlier, literature, you know, lots of different types of news and podcasts. You know, the world's a big place. History is vast. And I feel like there's so much more that we can learn and so much more we can do to enhance our medium and our craft by looking beyond just, you know, inspiration from the web.
I love that answer. There's so much out there. And once we get out of our environments and take in different inputs, I think we'll be surprised at how much that really impacts our work and our worldview. So I love that answer. What's your most invincible UX resource or tool you can recommend to our listeners? Speaking of tools.
Man, you know, so many of my tools are really conventional. I'm not the sort of person that gets super excited about a tool as like the thing that helps me do better work. I really like writing. I think that that's such an important part of what I do today, and I feel like it's something that we all could get better at and would serve our work regardless of what we do. I think designers are not always great at communicating their work, you know, talking about their work, sharing that with other people. And I find the act of writing is the act of critical thinking. It's the, wrestling with an idea, working through it, trying to find the right way to say it, boiling it down to the most efficient way to say it. Mm. So, you know, spending time writing, is that a tool? I think so. I think it's a tool for thinking.
Absolutely.
And I love Medium. I think that's a really amazing place to write and share things with people, because it's such a broad community where people are going to, they're actually going to pay attention. They're going to read it. They're going to comment, highlight. You kind of, you know, it's a safe place to get the feedback you need to become a better writer. I've found that I'm not a great writer. I have to work hard at it. It's painful for me to do, but the more that I do it, it gets a little bit easier every time.
I would argue that you are an incredible writer, and I can name two right now that really have blown my mind: A Seven Problems Growing Design Teams Face, which was a more recent one you posted on Medium, and the article you wrote called When Design Becomes a Black Box. That one, I said it on Twitter, and I meant it. It's the best article I've ever read as far as design collaboration is concerned. And so I'm going to link to both of those and everything else we've mentioned on this episode. Absolutely. Aaron, if you could recommend one book to our listeners, what would it be and why, in addition to Designing with Emotion, which I highly recommend?
So I'm going to recommend one that's sitting on my desk here. This is not a conventional recommendation, but it's called Make Space. And it's a book from the Stanford D School that's all about designing spaces that are creative and collaborative. And it's, you know, they've got awesome recommendations and ideas about how to build out specific things. Like, you can build out these rolling whiteboards. You can build, they call it a periodic table, which is basically a table on casters that's multifunctional for working on different types of projects, presenting work. It's such a great book. It's from the Stanford D School, and it's very thoughtful, and I have found it useful in my work. So, yeah, there's that book. And another one that I've been consulting on a regular basis is from Google Ventures, Sprint. You know,
that's, oh, yes.
It's become an instant classic. It's such a great book.
I need to read that.
Just understanding a process that's quick and iterative, and there's testing built in within a short period of time. It's a really great book.
We talk a lot about books on the show and the tremendous value reading has on your career and personal growth. As much as I love the written word, and I do, until I have the Flash's superpower, it can be really hard to find the time to sit down with one, which is why I've teamed up with Audible to offer you a free audiobook of your choice. All you have to do is visit audibletrial.com/userdefenders. Get this, even if you cancel your free trial, you still get to keep your book and feel the warm fuzzies in your heart because you'll be supporting the show. I love my Audible subscription, and I'm benefiting greatly from it. Might I recommend Design as a Job by Mike Montiero or Sprint by the Google Venture Guys? Give it a shot and get your free audiobook at audibletrial.com/userdefenders. Aaron, what's your best advice for aspiring UX design superheroes?
Stay humble.
Wow.
I think that I just see super talented young designers that get so confident and cocky in their work that they can no longer learn. I think, you know, staying humble, it's going to help you collaborate from other people. It's going to help you learn from other people. And it's going to keep you trying new things. That's my best advice.
That is excellent advice. So as we close, can you tell us about one thing you're working on that you're most excited about?
I am working on a lot of exciting things right now with the Envision design education team, things I'm very excited about. I'm doing a lot of writing and I'm doing a lot of research and studying of companies, design-driven companies, what works, what breaks, and identifying the best practices. So the Seven Common Problems article you mentioned earlier is an artifact of this research and that my colleague Eli Woolery and I are doing. And we are working on summing up our findings, and we're going to be sharing that publicly with a lot of folks in the near future. So stay tuned. That's about all I can say about that, but I'm very excited about it because, you know, my experience as a product designer and as I visit companies and study the way that companies work, I just see the same sorts of issues pop up over and over again. And I think that's a good thing, because if we see the same problems everywhere, that means we can probably find common solutions. And if we see, you know, common patterns of design-driven companies, of what they're doing and how they are successful, then those practices can be shared with a lot of people, and that can help us elevate the craft of design across the board. So I just think that's really exciting.
That's awesome, Aaron. I have so many more questions I could ask you, but I want to be respectful of your time. So maybe it'll be you'll be a return guest. You'll be my first return guest ever. That would be awesome.
Hey, that could be one of my superpowers.
Hey, now.
I just keep showing up.
Hey, I love it. Yeah, and from a bird's eye view too, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Awesome.
That's great.
So, Aaron, why don't you tell our audience the best way to connect and to keep up with you?
The best way to keep up with me is on Twitter. I'm just Aaron on Twitter. Now, the trick is my name is spelled with two A's and two R's because my dad misspelled my name at the hospital, and it's always stayed that way. But, yeah, just A-A-R-R-O-N on Twitter. My site is aaronwalter.com, and, yeah, it's probably the easiest way to get in touch with me.
Awesome. Aaron, so awesome to have you here on the podcast. It's been a real honor and a pleasure. Thank you for all the value you added. I can't wait to share this episode, and I just want to say, fight on, my friend.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure. It's been fun chatting with you.
Wow, right? How about that interview with the Falcon? I love his superhero name. He truly does have a 30,000-foot view into our field. He's so humble, too, about some of his superpowers, such as his writing. And I'll tell you, some of the greatest design articles I've read have been penned by him. I've linked to those in the show notes as well. And I do want to thank you so much for listening, Defenders. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I read something recently that reminded me of one of those things we say so often, but we don't really consider the meaning of it. It's paying attention. We pay it because it's probably one of our most valuable currencies, right? And I don't take it for granted that you choose to pay attention to this show and these episodes and my guests. And I just want to thank you so much for taking the time. And I hope this show is bringing a lot of value to you in your career, in your life, in your personal growth. Yeah. So always here for you if you ever want to reach out and say hello or anything. So you can email me at userdefenders@gmail.com. If you're enjoying the show, I'd leap over tall buildings if you'd take a minute to leave a rating and review on iTunes by visiting userdefenders.com/review. Or if you're on your phone, there's a link in the show notes that will teleport you right to it. Because I know you fight for the users, I encourage you to subscribe to the bi-weekly Bugle at userdefenders.com/join to find out who the next super guest is and get my usable thoughts. I want to thank Cesar Limas for the astonishing superhero artwork, Chris Combs for the superhuman editing, and Wyman Gentry for the compelling show music. Thanks again so much for listening, and until next time, fight on, my friends.